Pop Health Podcast is a public service of 24-Hour Home Care. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Pop Health Podcast. My name is Gavin Ward, and I am the host or a host of Pop Health Podcast alongside Zach Morgan today. Hey, Zach, how's it going?
Hello, I'm also a host.
Thanks, Zach. So we're really excited today. We have a guest who was actually up pretty early this morning, and that is Judy Thomas, who is the Chief Executive Officer for the Coalition for Compassionate Care of California. Judy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me to be here. I'm really excited.
Great. So you were up at 3:30 this morning, is that correct?
Yep, on that first flight out of Sacramento to Burbank.
Very good. And how was the traffic coming from Burbank to our recording location?
Oh, it's totally crazy. It's LA traffic.
Yeah, very good. What's traffic like in Sacramento?
Well, we do have rush hour, but it's only during rush hour.
Okay, nice. Very good. Southwest, correct?
Correct.
Very good. Well, again,
non-sponsored shout out.
Oh, yeah. A little shout out there. Non-sponsored. Well said. So today we're going to talk a little bit more about what the Coalition for Compassionate Care of California does and a little bit more about Judy's role. But before we get into that, can you tell us maybe a little bit about yourself that the audience may not know about you or that would surprise us?
Well, the thing that I picked as a fun fact to share is that in my family history, there is some innovation in the healthcare field, and that was my great-grandfather. He was the first doctor in the U.S. to set bones without cutting open the skin. They were doing that technology or that procedure, that process in Europe. They developed it there, and he went to Europe to learn it and brought it back to the U.S.
Wow. What do you know what country in Europe and where he started here in the States?
Well, I know that he was back east.
Okay.
But I don't know where they were doing it in Europe.
Okay, very good. So tell us a little bit, perhaps, about what is the Coalition for Compassionate Care California and how it got started.
The Coalition for Compassionate Care is all about helping people get the care that they want in the face of serious illness. And we started in 1998. There actually was another organization, the Center for Healthcare Decisions. They brought together a group of people to develop recommendations on what's good end-of-life care look like in nursing homes. And as they were wrapping up that project, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation came out with a grant called Community-State Partnerships. And that group applied for the grant and did receive it. And so that turned into the Coalition for Compassionate Care. That's how we were born. And we were first based at the California Hospital Association,
okay,
essentially a project of the Hospital Association. And we grew gradually over time, going from one project to another project, and eventually in 2010, really became our own separate organization. So from that original grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, we're kind of unique. There are a few coalitions that have continued to exist in other states. Most of those that got grants, though, they weren't able to continue after the grants. Some that have, they tend to be just kind of like a one-person shop. So we're very unusual that we have grown and been able to have as big an impact as we have here in California.
Okay, great. How's your organization structured, if you mind me asking, from like a personnel standpoint?
We have 12 staff, some that are part-time, so it's like 9 FTEs.
Okay.
And when I tell people that, I mean, often they're like, wow, I'm really surprised, because they see the results of our work and the impact that we've had. And actually, some of that impact we did when our staff was maybe a third of the size that it is now.
Very good. So small and mighty.
Yeah. And I know that obviously as a coalition, you are very involved in public policy and development of resources, those kinds of things. But what are some of the focuses of the coalition itself? I know things like advanced care planning, but also things like palliative care and pediatrics, things like that. Do you mind just elaborating a little bit on some of the focuses?
Yeah, I'd love to. And maybe I'll just step back a bit and say, kind of philosophically, we see our work as being about changing culture. And in order to create the system of serious illness care that we want for us and our loved ones, we have to change culture, both on a societal level and the healthcare system culture. And a coalition lends itself really well to that kind of work of changing culture. And we serve as kind of the hub or the big tent where everybody can come together to work on these things collaboratively. Within that, our projects tend to focus kind of really in two big camps. And one is promoting conversations, advanced care planning, goals of care, those kinds of conversations about medical treatment wishes, serious illness, and palliative care, and making palliative care available across the continuum of care.
And for those listeners who may not know, obviously palliative care is somewhat of a newer idea or a newer, more accepted idea recently. Do you mind giving just kind of a brief breakdown of the difference between palliative care and hospice or end-of-life care?
Yes. So palliative care grew out of hospice, so it often gets kind of confused. And because we do define it as, well, it's not hospice, but it's like it.
Okay.
So palliative care, though, really stands on its own, that it is a medical treatment that is focused on the pain, symptoms, and stress associated with a serious illness, providing an extra layer of support on top of the other care that you're receiving, appropriate at any age and at any stage of illness. Hospice started many years ago as a Medicare benefit for people who are in that late stage of life and dying. And CMS didn't want, or Congress didn't want too many people using the benefit, so they put some restrictions on it, that you had to have a prognosis of 6 months or less if the illness follows its normal course. And it was structured in such a way that essentially you have to forgo curative treatment. So it's designed for people who are at that point where it's very clear. This is terminal. There's nothing to do to try to address the underlying condition. And I really want to go into a very different kind of delivery of care, coming into my home with a team. So that's what hospice is. Palliative care is that same philosophy, saying, you know, there's a lot of people long before that point in time right. that would benefit from it.
And I think that's an important distinction that people get confused sometimes, especially as palliative care is becoming more and more prominent, that maybe it's a precursor to hospice care, which it, just like you said, it doesn't need to be or have to be at all. Sometimes it may be, but that's not necessarily the requirement of it.
Correct. Yeah. Now we're hearing a lot of people say palliative care is appropriate to start at the point of diagnosis.
Excellent.
And we are finding that, particularly with cancer care, the recommendations and the guidance has really shifted in the last few years, where they're saying, you know, at that point of diagnosis of a serious cancer, palliative care should be part of what's discussed by the medical team. You know, early on in the disease, you're going to have less palliative care
right.
than when it's later stage.
Sure.
But it's all about helping a person have the highest quality of life possible.
Right. And CMS obviously agrees. They're increasing the hospice payments next year significantly, a couple of $100 million, I believe. But do you mind telling the audience a little bit about how you yourself got involved working with those who are seriously ill or nearing the end of life?
Yeah. When I was growing up, my dad used to say that people choose their death. And he didn't really elaborate on it, but I knew that what he meant was how you live, how you take care of your health, what your values are, it affects your health determines kind of also what your health is at the end of your life. And it's often said people die the way they live. So kind of those factors, all of us every day in some way are kind of laying the foundation for that very late part of life. And I had a couple other experiences, you know, when I was a kid, when I was in elementary school, one of my classmates was killed suddenly in a car accident. And the teacher mentioned a memorial service, and I thought, well, of course I'll go. And my best friend asked me to go with her, so her mom took us. And the three of us were the only ones from my class there.
Wow.
I was shocked.
Yeah.
And then when I was a teenager, my grandfather, who had very advanced dementia, my grandparents came and lived with my family, and several years after being cared for at home by my mom, he did pass away in our house.
Which is so tough. The family caregiving part of end of life can be such traumatic experience, beautiful in some ways, but so incredibly difficult in others.
That is so true, really. I think the situation with my grandfather was very hard on my mom.
I would agree. From personal family experience as well, I think that, yeah, it can be very difficult. But on a brighter note, your organization has been very successful in implementing some things to bring education and also policy changes to the forefront. Do you mind telling us a little bit about some of your successes?
Yeah, we've had a lot. The one I think that kind of showcases the variety of things that we do is our effort to bring pulsed physician orders for life-sustaining treatment to California. In fact, we've been so successful that sometimes people just identify us with pulsed, but we do a lot more than just that. So just in a nutshell, if you're not familiar with pulsed, it is a medical order, complements the advanced directive, turning it wishes in that into a medical order, and it's for people who are very late stage, medically frail, advanced chronic illness, wouldn't be surprised if they die in the next year. So in order to establish that as really a community standard practice in California, you know, it had already been created in Oregon and was established in the literature. But what we did was we got legislation passed, and we did that in 1 year.
Wow.
Which, yeah.
That's incredible.
So I think that's part of our success. We're very strategic. When we go for legislation, we're very strategic about it.
Yeah.
Standardized the form for California to make it clear there was just one single form. We looked at what Oregon had done. We tweaked it just a little bit. We created a 2-day training on the conversation because the form is only as good as the conversation on which it's based. We got 25 local coalitions established because you can do all you want at the state level, but if it doesn't change what happens at the bedside, you've done nothing.
Right.
We have a lot of trainers, we have a lot of volunteers. Our curriculum has even been adopted by several other states. They've taken it and modified it for their post programs because people like it so much, it's so comprehensive. But some other things that we have going on, as I mentioned, the legislative track record, we're strategic in the sense that we do our due diligence before we want to sponsor legislation. So you get the politics worked out ahead of time. You don't go over to the Capitol and then go, oh, what, you don't like this? Don't move it until you have the politics all lined up. We're a coalition. We can't afford to upset people.
Right, sure.
And have a plan after it's passed, have a plan for implementing it. Because a lot of legislation sits around and nothing happens because there's not a plan and there's nobody driving the ship. So
absolutely,
those things are really important. We do a lot of work with diversity. And kind of our approach to education is very hands-on. We want to train skills. We want to teach people to think in a more effective and efficient manner so that they can show up, again, for the patients, really to be present for them. And we get some really great feedback. One of our trainees who went through our diversity training, he said afterwards, I thought my patient was non-compliant. Now I know I was just imposing my culture on my patient.
Yeah.
So some pretty profound stuff. We've done some ethnographic research about listening deeply, learned some things about caregivers and patients and what their experiences are. We have a strong partnership with UCLA to help them implement advanced care planning across their entire healthcare system.
Wow, great.
Kind of starting at the two ends of the very high need, medically complex patients who come there for the miracle and the cure. So it's like, how do you introduce that conversation in that context?
Right.
And then also at the other end, they're working with kind of lay navigators mm-hmm. Embedded in the physician's offices.
Good. And when you say lay navigators, can you clarify to the audience what that means exactly?
Well, they call them comprehensive care navigators or okay. comprehensive care coordinators. So there's lots of different names. They could be a community health worker. There's lots of different names. But basically, they're regular people. They haven't gone through any particular healthcare training. They're not nurses or doctors. And they supplement the healthcare team, kind of just being normal people and helping patients better understand their condition and how to navigate through the healthcare.
Great. Thank you.
Excellent. So obviously very successful over the years. What challenges have you faced?
Well, with the work itself, I always feel like there's always opportunity. You know, of course, not everyone wants to talk about serious illness or death right. and dying, but But there's people who do. And so we're always trying to find, you know, those folks where you have that opportunity, kind of that glide path, and keep moving it forward. Really, I feel perhaps it's particularly the timing right now, but our biggest challenge is really just the organizational structure, because we're such an unusual animal. The funding and the operation, it's not really obvious. We don't have a lot of counterparts to turn to figure out how to keep maintaining the resources it takes to do this very broad cultural shift as the big tent involving all the key stakeholders.
So that is actually leads in brilliantly to where we kind of wanted to go to, but where does the funding for your organization come from typically?
Yeah, it's grants and donations, so about 3/4 of that is grants. And I'd like to do a shout out to California Healthcare Foundation, Archstone Foundation, John and Juana Harmon Foundation, Stubsky Foundation, and John A. Hartford Foundation as some of our key foundation supporters. The donations, we do have some major sponsors, which include Sutter Health, the Alliance of Celtic Healthcare, Cedars-Sinai, and Citrus Valley. So we really appreciate our major supporters. And then it's also donations from regular everyday people. When we get registration fees for our training, attendance at our summit, we do have an online store where we sell a few materials, and we have a consulting service to help communities or healthcare organizations that want to implement advanced care planning.
Sure. And just kind of on that note, outside of the funding aspect, I know that partnerships with healthcare organizations or working with healthcare organizations is obviously a big part of what you do. What does that look like? What kind of organizations do you work with? What kind of work do you do with them?
Yeah, so with our grant-funded research or work, it tends to be very more in a collaborative way, working with folks as advisors, that and doing things that will spread it across large groups. Through our consulting service, we go in and work with specific organizations, really tailoring work to them. It varies quite a lot, but a lot of it falls into education, yeah. Kind of doing education, helping. We really believe in a train-the-trainer model because we want this to become part of the culture of the organizations and our state, so we want it to be give people the tools to replicate that.
Right.
Very good. So you're doing a train the trainer, allowing for the spread of the work that you're doing. So let's say 5 years from now, what are you hoping to see here in California and the impact on your work?
That's a great question. So with our work, we really want to see that these conversations about serious illness are just a normal part of everyday life. Happening around the kitchen table, happening at the water cooler at work, places of worship, senior centers, so that the public, this is part of public discourse.
Yeah.
We also want to see our healthcare providers feeling skilled and competent in these conversations, not thrown off when this topic comes up, knowing how to navigate that in a way that really honors them and their patient and strengthens their relationship with the patient. And we want to see our organizations, our healthcare organizations, have systems in place. Because right now it relies too much on the individual, professional, you know, being passionate about this.
Right.
So how do you identify which patients are appropriate for this conversation and where, and it's multiple conversations, so where on the trajectory, which part of the conversation do you need to have now? How do you get that documented? How do you get that to the right place at the right time? Who has the responsibility to have the conversation? Are they trained in it? Are they compensated for it? So there's a lot of factors building this into our healthcare system of delivering care.
Makes sense. I know even just among my family and friends, having tough conversations about not necessarily end of life, but potential end of life or heading in that direction. I've family members who just don't want to talk about it and just ignore it. And I know there's sometimes physicians or other professionals who don't want to give up. Even though the evidence is clear that, hey, let's make this let's be compassionate with this individual and help them enjoy the rest of their life. But I know because of the education I've received over the last few years through, I know Pulse Coalition, like down in Orange County, for example, which I'm sure you guys influenced and helped set up, I've kind of shifted my thinking, and I'm hopeful that the rest of the culture can as well, that sometimes it's appropriate to adjust our way of thinking depending on someone's circumstances. So I do hope you've been successful. I know you've been successful so far, and look forward to seeing where you guys are in 5 years and beyond. How can the audience support you guys or learn more about your organization, Judy?
Well, there's lots of ways to get involved, and one is to become a member. So we do have membership, and join the movement. Attend a class, listen to a webinar. You can make a donation. You can connect. We can help you connect to people locally, such as the Orange County Pulse Coalition, which is now ACP Partners, or attend our summit in March. Particularly if you're here in California, that summit really is a way to bring together the palliative care community to co-create the future of palliative care. It's not just your usual conference, which is one-way information. It really is intended to help shape the future and a common vision together.
Where is that summit in March?
This year it's going to be in Sacramento.
Okay, Sacramento. And you say this year, when is it, the March one or?
In March. March of 2017.
Okay. Got it. Great. Sacramento. Ah, interesting choice.
Yeah. Well, we do alternate between Northern and Southern California.
Okay, great. For those of you that don't know, I was joking because I know Judy's based in Sacramento, so just teasing her a little bit.
And if people are looking for any of those resources, the website is CoalitionCCC, so CoalitionCCC.org, correct?
Correct.
Great.
And lastly, I actually forgot to ask earlier, you mentioned you were able to pass legislation within a year. And a lot of that had to do with planning. You had an implementation. You mentioned having a champion to drive that forward as well. Are you able to share with us who in Sacramento or who in the state was your advocate through this process or your advocates through that process?
Yeah, we've worked closely with Senator Wolk several times. She's based up in the representing kind of the Yolo County area. And it was actually kind of a fluke how we ended up with her. It was the last day for the bill introduction deadline for the Pulse. When we were introducing the Pulse bill, and I just knew that her predecessor in her district had some interest in this area. It was Helen Thompson, who had carried pain as a fifth vital sign.
Okay.
So I said, what the heck, I'm just going to go. And I met with their chief of staff, and he says to me, well, she's not in today. She's busy finding a place, assisted living, for her mother-in-law. I really don't think she's going to be interested in this, but I'll ask her. Like, okay, great. A couple hours later, he calls me and goes, I don't get it, but she wants to carry this bill. Woohoo!
Awesome.
And so it's actually, I think, been part of her really kind of crowning achievement, one piece that she's very proud of.
Yeah.
And she finds when she goes out and she talks to her constituents, they're actually really interested in this topic.
Awesome, Judy. Well, it's been pretty neat to learn more about your organization today and see the great work you've done over the years. And I know Zach and I are big believers in the work that you're doing, and I'm hopeful our audience of healthcare professionals agrees. I'm sure they do. And again, the website is coalitionccc.org. We do have a summit in March, so healthcare professionals out there who do interact with the chronically ill or serve in palliative care and hospice or end-of-life care, it might be a great opportunity to learn more from the website. Judy Thomas has been our guest, the Chief Executive Officer for the Coalition for Compassionate Care of California. Judy, any final words for our audience?
Well, I really enjoyed being here today. And
yeah, so Judy's thinking enough. Any final words here?
Yeah.
Well, I have a question before we finish off, because we mentioned the Pulse form quite a few times. Yeah. Is it typically pink? Or is that just like an organization by organization form? Or might people recognize it as the bright pink form that they get?
So for folks that are outside of California and in other states, Pulse is a national movement, and almost every state has some Pulse activity going on. But the form itself is decided state by state. There are a few that use another color like green, but most of them are pink. And it is always part of the Pulse paradigm that it needs to be honored regardless of what color it's printed on. But the bright color is part of making sure that it stands out in the medical chart.
Right. Very good.
Excellent.
Zach, thanks so much for joining as well today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. I enjoy this topic. It's close to my heart, so I have enjoyed being here very much. Thank you.
Very good. And for the audience, just a friendly reminder, Pop Health Podcast is a not-for-profit service of 24-hour home care that we do not take advertisers. We do not take any revenue. So if you do like the podcast, if it's beneficial for your learning, please like us on iTunes. Feel free to subscribe there. You can also download or listen to episodes on pophealthpodcast.com. Your likes, your downloads do help us get guests like Judy and some of the other folks that we've had throughout California, Arizona, and Texas. Thanks so much, everybody. Stay tuned for the next episode. Take care.